Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we've been talking about Washington lobbyists. Now we're going to meet one. And as I'm sure you've heard, obesity is a big problem in the United States. Yes, a big problem, pun intended. According to the Centers for Disease Control, 30% of U.S. adults, that's over 60 million people, are obese. Fad diets come and go. Lawyers sue fast food makers. Whole milk is eliminated from school lunch programs as we attempt to deal with what some term an epidemic. My next guest offers a personal account of the story in his memoir of battling weight, and as one of the top Washington lobbyists, he may offer insight on the public policy side of America's weight problem as well. Michael Berman's new book is Living Large, A Big Man's Ideas on Weight, Success, and Acceptance, published by Rodale Books. Michael Berman, welcome to WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning, Ryan.
Give us a little bit of your background. First, you're one of the top Washington lobbyists at the firm of the Duberstein Group, Ken Duberstein, President Reagan's former chief of staff. But you're on the Democratic side of things.
I worked for Fitzmondo when he was vice president and when he was a senator.
And let's see. So how did you go? Let's talk about that revolving door a little bit first. Yes. What people see as a revolving door between government and lobbying. How did you wind up working for the vice president and then going on to this?
Well, I'm from Minnesota, and I was actually he hired me right out of law school when he was still the Attorney General of Minnesota. And I went to work in the Attorney General's office, and then he went down to the Senate. This was 1964. And then 2 years later, after his reelection campaign, he invited me to come down to work on his Senate staff, which I did for most of the next 6 years, rising from a job basically as his bag carrier, if you will, until I was chief of staff of the office by the time I left Washington the first time around.
So presumably when you're chief of staff for the vice president of the United States, you're consumed with questions of the national interest. Then when you're a lobbyist working for clients, then you're consumed with questions of their special interest. Is that a fair way to look at it?
Well, yes, if you want to call them special interests, it is their interest, their commercial interest. It's a different set of interests, to be sure, although they're not necessarily always in conflict. And by the way, I was chief of staff to him as vice president. I was his counsel as senator, I was his counsel when he was vice president.
Gotcha. So what's it like lobbying in Washington these days? Is there a chill in the air since the Abramoff scandal broke?
There's some, but quite frankly, the Abramoff situation was such an aberration, even for Washington, it's hard to find anybody else that would even suggest that other people were operating in the same way he chose to operate. This was not a case, frankly, of where somebody decided to accidentally slipped a few rules. This is a situation which it would appear, and I only know from newspaper accounts, where he set out to simply not follow any of the rules or the laws, as has become clear.
We had Emily Yaffe of Slate.com on the show recently after her Lobbyist for a Day adventure, where she kind of posed as a lobbyist. And she wrote that you were the only big-time lobbyist who would meet with her and give her pointers. And she said you also actually teach a class in lobbying and that you're very open about what's good about it, what's bad about it. And you actually defend the practice of lobbying and its place in our democracy, yes?
Yes, absolutely. Because I talk to anybody that calls me, quite frankly, and she looked like she had such an interesting project. We sat here, and she wrote a great story afterwards.
She pretended she was a lobbyist from a fake, I think it was an oil company that she made up.
No, actually, she did something with animals, I think, protecting certain kinds of animals.
Oh, I'm getting her confused with somebody else who did something similar. That's right.
She did something that was much more likely to be just a person from the neighborhood or from a community that had this particular interest. I think it had to do with cats. Actually.
Right. So in theory, a lobbyist has a legitimate place in our democracy because you want the right of the people to petition their government to be pretty free. But in practice, people would say the Abramoff scandal was not an aberration because it just represented the kind of over the edge tip of the iceberg of corporations and industries and sometimes unions and others who have a concentration of money, being able to spend it to attain a concentration of power, and that distorts our democracy.
Well, we've had lobbyists forever, and what I do teach, I actually teach the ethics course as part of a 2-week short course that American University offers on lobbying and government service. And we've had lobbyists forever. I think you have to think about lobbyists. If you represent a large company, for example, that has hundreds of thousands of employees, to be sure you're representing the company, but you're also representing a company which employs a lot of people. So that there's a lot more to it than saying you're just representing some large, wealthy company. Every one of those companies has people that work for it. They have vendors that supply it. So it's a much broader commercial interest, I think. But the reason I think Abramoff was an aberration is that most people don't lie and cheat. Most of work that lobbyists do now are making substantive cases. Yes, we try to find out, make relationships with offices so that we can at least have our case be heard. I mean, that's what we do. And there's now almost 30,000 lobbyists in Washington alone.
By the way, our previous guest, Matthew Continetti from the Weekly Standard, argues in his new book that the growth of lobbyists and K Street and the lobbying industry in general was ironically an outgrowth of an attempt at campaign finance reform after the Nixon Watergate scandal, where Congress decided that money in politics was more of the problem than it really was, in Continetti's opinion, and so they clamped down on big donations by individuals. And this led to the creation of the current system, where a lot of the money is poured in more indirectly, meaning through the lobbying firms. Do you agree with that history?
Well, I agree with the history that it's had an effect. But in fact, what the campaign finance laws did was to restrict large donors. But many of those donors still are influential in that they, instead of being able to give large sums, they go out and raise sums of money from lots of people. So that hasn't changed much. And political action committees and various interest groups have been with us pretty much forever, although they're more structured now. It's all on the other thing the laws did was to put everything on the public record. So if you want to find out who I contribute to or who a particular company contributes to, now that we're online, you could go to your computer right now and determine every contribution I've made to a federal candidate in the last, I think they're back 8 or 10 years now that they have up on the system. And certainly that's true of the political action committees of various companies. So it's not that it's coming in through lobbyists. Now, what he may be referring to is that there's a lot of grassroots lobbying that goes on that is not disclosed publicly. Our firm doesn't happen to do that, but it's where you try to get people involved that have an interest in a particular piece of legislation to contact their member of Congress, and that goes by the boards.
My guest on WNYC is Michael Berman, who is a leading lobbyist in Washington, D.C. with the Duberstein Group. He's also the author of a new book called Living Large, A Big Man's Ideas on Weight, Success, and Acceptance, published by Rodale Book. And you've been fighting your weight all your life, haven't you?
Absolutely. I've been fat since I was a little baby.
And I take it you agree with the use of the word epidemic when talking about obesity in America?
Yes, it's clearly, it has grown for a variety of reasons, I think. Our lives have changed so much. When I was growing up, maybe when you were growing up, I don't know how old you are, you walked to school, it would be 8-10 blocks perhaps each way, and there was a lot more outdoor play, and there weren't television sets in front of which we could sit at the end of the day or into the evening, or computers at which we could play games or even do our work. So that there was much more physical activity involved than there is now. I think the second thing that's changed enormously is how we eat. Certainly when I grew up, we sat down at the same table with the rest of my family every single night. It'd be a rare exception when I was in high school, for example, that we weren't home for dinner with my parents and my sisters.
And yet all of that, growing up when you did, didn't prevent you from becoming obese.
No, I ate food anytime I could lay my hands on it. I would get up in the middle of the night and take cookies or anything that was edible out of the cupboards in the kitchen. My view is that over time, my view has become over time after many years of therapy as well, that I had some psychological issues, and food was a way that I could ameliorate some of those concerns that I had. But for me, food has been a problem since early on, and no other member of my family. I did some research, and there's no other fat person in my family going back at least through my great-grandparents' generation.
And I gather from the book that you found a measure of peace with your weight problem and more success at attacking it when you started seeing it as a disease?
Absolutely. When I came to understand, which was well into my 50s, unfortunately, that really I was dealing with a chronic disease, that I was never going to be able to cure it and be a thin person or even an average-sized person. And then what I had to do was to manage it just the way I happen to have kidney disease, and we manage that in a particular fashion, or I have high blood pressure, we manage that in a particular fashion. I believe you have to do the same thing if you're a really fat person.
I assume you've tried a lot of diets, and probably a lot of listeners have been through diets themselves, or at least paid attention to some of the ideological diet wars, you know, low fat versus low carbs and all of that. Do you have an opinion, or did any of them work for you?
All of them worked for me. I mean, the issue, Brian, really is not so much losing weight, as strange as that may seem. It is keeping it off once you lose it. It's the maintenance of the weight lost. And I've tried, you name it, if it was a popular diet, I tried it. I was in two or three different residential programs where I would be on programs for 2 or 3 weeks on end with exercise and appropriate nutrition and learning all about nutrition. I always lost large amounts of weight, and I always gained it back until this last time when I basically kept off about 90 pounds from my top weight.
Your book is called Living Large, A Big Man's Ideas on Weight, Success, and Acceptance. Do you think there's a relationship between your weight and your professional success?
Well, yes and no. I chose, because I was always concerned about my size and my appearance and how people would react to me, I chose professionally, whether in politics or in the other work I did, or even as a lawyer, to do things where I was not in the public eye, kind of behind the curtain, if you will, and because I didn't want to be public. And so I became really very good at things in campaigns and obviously in my work as a lobbyist, and before that as a lawyer. So you kind of worked a little harder, I think. You maybe took on some tasks that other people didn't want to take on because you wanted to be successful at them, but you weren't the person that was out getting the plaudits all the time. So I think it did affect me, and that hard work paid off over time in what's been a really terrific life.
Was there more of a temptation to overeat because you were in this high-flying lobbyist world?
It's not the lobbyist world. It's the campaign world.
Mm-hmm.
On my website, there's a whole series of I have a long, long chart on weights. And if you look at the various presidential campaigns I've worked on over the years, I would gain 30, 40, 50. I think the top was 60 pounds over a three-month period in one campaign. The pressure cooker of 7 days a week, of 12 to 14 to 16 hours a day. And what do you do? Well, I call food kind of a legal kind of Valium, if you will. You don't need a prescription for it. And so I used food to soothe myself, and I gained huge amounts of weight during those periods.
My guest is Michael Berman, Washington lobbyist, whose book is about something else, primarily Living Large, A Big Man's Ideas on Weight, Success, and Acceptance. We have a link to his webpage on our webpage. You can go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show to get there. Do you think we're too hard on the obese as a society in America?
Well, actually, there's some recent work that the Pew Research Center has just done, and the data would be that we're very conscious of the fact. Most people think that we deal more harshly with fatter people than we do with average-sized people, although the people who are fatter don't tend to be as dramatic in that enunciation wheel of that kind of activity. Although one thing that is quite dramatic is that fat women find a much more difficult time than fat men, by almost 2 to 1 in terms of people expressing themselves about whether they felt they've been discriminated against or treated badly because of their weight. The vastly larger numbers of women say that than men do.
But it's an interesting perception issue that with all your political savvy, you felt that you could never be the front man, the one who actually runs for the office, because of your appearance.
Yes, very clearly. Or even in the things I chose to do in politics. So I was never a press secretary, for example, where I'd have to stand up and do a press conference, or other kinds of things where you were public. I always chose things that were private, you know, in the back room stuff.
It's in the American character to think every problem has a solution. Should we try to get better at just accepting imperfections in general? Does that relate to this?
Well, I think we do have to get better at accepting imperfections, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we have to simply give up and say, gee, obesity is not a problem. If you're going to be fat, you're going to be fat. I mean, I think there's a lot of things that people can do. From my point of view, it's most important, if you're an adult at least, to get your life really in order, to feel good about yourself, to see to your health, to get involved in exercise, which I didn't start exercising until I was 52 years old. And now I do exercise and yoga.
What was your top weight?
332 pounds.
And you're 90 below that now.
Yes, I'm about 240 today.
How much is being overweight about the external, saying I'm here to the world, and how much is it about internal battles of control, do you think?
I don't think it's much of the former, although if you're a really large person and you're involved in various settings and meetings, you do have the capacity to command attention. I've used it over the years. If you're a large person, people know you're there, and if you sit quietly for a while, when you decide to start speaking, people just tend to listen.
We've got about a minute left. I want to come back to the policy realm and kind of combine the two. What do you think of U.S. government policy with respect to health and weight? And, you know, as a lobbyist, I don't know if you would take on something like McDonald's or some of the other, you know, large food producers that try to push unhealthy foods on us, foods that would tend to make us obese. Where do you think policy comes into this?
Well, I don't think the answer is to attack the food processors, and I don't happen to represent any of them. I think the answer is we have to get back to thinking about the kinds of lives that young people should live in terms of the kinds of meals they should eat, the kinds of education they should get about what is good for them, and how their lives will be better if they eat in a healthy lifestyle and exercise. But I don't think the answer is to go and say, well, there's this convenience food out there. It's very fast. I've decided to buy it because it's easy for me. And if you look at it, most people buy convenience food. Three-quarters of the people buy convenience food because it's fast and easy to get to. That's why it's convenience food.
And it's cheap in many cases.
And for the quantities you get, it's cheap because that's part of the marketing. How much more can you get for this quarter or this dollar or this $5 bill?
10 seconds.
I think we can get into the idea where we're starting to teach young people about healthy eating habits.
Michael Berman, author of Living Large, A Big Man's Ideas on Weight, Success, and Acceptance, published by Rodale Books. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
WNYC is supported by the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University, hosting two open houses for its executive MPH program in health services management in New Jersey May 2nd and New York May 9th, 212-305-0298.
Some upcoming programs tomorrow. What do we owe Darfur? Wednesday, Governor Corzine. Thursday, former Inspector General of the Homeland Security Department, Clark Kent Irvin. So a lot to listen for every weekday at 10 a.m. Architect Raphael Vignoli has designed some of the world's most prestigious concert halls, from Philadelphia's Kimmel Center to the Jazz at Lincoln Center Theater. And today on Soundcheck, he discusses the music that inspires his designs. That's coming up at 2 o'clock this afternoon on 93.9 WNYC. And don't forget, you can hear any of our recent programs on the WNYC website. Go to WNYC.org, then just click on Brian Lehrer Show to hear recent programs or sign up for our free podcast.